Hi there, folks. Welcome to the Trump Republic. Here on the minefield, we are discussing the only thing that there is to discuss in the world at the moment, it seems. So we try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. I think it's fair to say that no election has thrown them up so thick and fast as this one. Waleed Ali is my name. I'm joining you from the Radio Foundation studios in New York City. And I'm speaking with my co-host, Scott Stevens, who's back in Australia at a safe distance from what has just gone down across the United States. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Waleed. We really do have to do something about the ABC's travel budget, though, don't we? I mean, this would have been a blast to do from over there. Well, anyway, we accept what we're given, do we not? Yes. We they say, you know, that the elections change the nation, and if that was ever the case, it's certainly the case here. In fact, I would even say that the America that most people woke up to on the 9th of November is a fundamentally different nation to the one the day before the election. And I think, Waleed, you could even see this reflected, couldn't you, at the howls of bewilderment, the incredulity, even the despair that so many Americans expressed as the unimaginable unfolded before their eyes, namely a Trump victory at the end of what has been really quite a strange, unpredictable, quite unedifying presidential campaign. Many confessed, in fact, that they didn't recognize the nation that had turned out to vote. And I think there's an awful lot in that to unpack. Nevertheless, Trump, being the benevolent dictator that he no doubt will be, tried to reach out across this now bitterly divided nation. Here's what he said to his adoring throng in the early hours of Wednesday morning.
For those who have chosen not to support me in the past, of which there were a few people, I'm reaching out to you for your guidance and your help, so that we can work together and unify our great country.
Like, it's really interesting, though, Willie, that, you know, one of the problems, one of the truisms, I suppose, of Democratic politics is they say that you've got to campaign in poetry, but then you're forced to govern in prose. What Donald Trump seems to be holding out is the possibility that, yes, he may well have campaigned in smut and bile, but he may yet govern sensibly and even benevolently. And that, of course, is certainly what his defeated opponent, Hillary Clinton, is hoping for.
Donald Trump is going to be our president. We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead.
There we are, Hillary Clinton, the vanquished. Okay, here's the way that I want to frame this, Waleed, and I'm not sure what you're going to make of it, so, you know, let's see how we go. It seems to me that, you know, whatever happens with Trump, I mean, he may well simply be a kind of domestic figurehead of congressional leadership. And can I point out that in many ways, the real story here is that not only did Trump win the presidency, but he's also taken along with him both the Congress and the Senate, who have returned to Republican majority. That is huge.
In a Senate election that was meant to go against Republicans. So next Senate election will probably favor Republicans and expand their control of the Senate.
Absolutely right. I mean, this is quite extraordinary. And I think there's a very real chance that Trump will simply be, if you like, a domestic figurehead. He will be there as sort of, you know, eye candy, if you like, for disenfranchised Republican voters. But it'll be congressional leadership that has the real muscle. I think that's a very real possibility. But the fact is that as soon as Trump was elected, whatever moral problems he presented stopped being about him and they became about the people who voted for him. In other words, he is now no longer simply a political sideshow, a mere misogynist, an unreconstructed bigot, an aberration. He is now the expression of national identity. He is, if you like, the will of the nation. So it seems to me that with this election, what's happened is that the real problem has shifted from the sheer indecency of the man, or even the bankruptcy of the party that put him there, to the type of people who voted for him. What does Trump mean for the nature, the identity of the American nation itself? And that, for me, you know, the real problem is to move now away from the person and to work out what on earth does this mean about the people. What do you think?
Right. And I think that's actually an urgent question, not just for the United States, but actually for the world and for Australia.
Mm.
Because the real question that confronts Australians right now, I think, is what will Trump's victory inspire in us?
Yeah.
And that is utterly dependent on how we choose to interpret Trump's victory, right? What we think it was really about. And I want to confess something to you, Scott. I have found, so, you know, I've been in the United States for, what, 10 days through this election campaign for the last 10 days. I went out to a Trump rally in Pennsylvania. I've sort of seen things through lenses that you simply can't view them in Australia. And the Trump phenomenon looks very different from here, at least to me. It doesn't look like a campaign and a movement, as he would put it, that is simply, unmitigatedly about things like racism and misogyny.
Mm.
Which is definitely the way it was framed in Australia, right? So that's when Trump made headlines to us. The minute he started talking about, I don't know, free trade or whatever, the wonks would pay attention, everyone else would switch off, and we'd kind of move on to the next thing that Tony Abbott had said about Malcolm Turnbull or something like that. When watching it from here, though, I think we've seen something different. And to some extent, the exit polls tell a bit of the story. And I understand there are perils associated with quoting any sort of poll at the moment, given the way the polls performed in this campaign and then what the ultimate result was. But if you look at some of the exit poll results, really interesting. 70% of voters, as they were asked when they were leaving the ballot point, said they were concerned about the allegations against Trump in respect of the way he treated women. 70% said they would like to see illegal immigrants given a path towards legality. Only 25% said they wanted to see them deported. A minority support this idea of building a wall. This is not a nation that has voted for the Trump as presented to the Australian public through the little snippets that we get, and perhaps even to many within the American public. This is a different thing to that. And if you want to start talking electoral maps, the thing that I noticed is where he won it. I mean, the racism and so on, that all played. It was all relevant. I'm not denying that. You have the Ku Klux Klan endorsing him. That's clearly playing a factor, right? But if you look at where he wins it in states that the Democrats have banked for decades. Mm-hmm. He wins it in places like Wisconsin. He wins it in Michigan. He wins it in Pennsylvania, which, as it happens, is where I went to that rally. And there, I think you were seeing, and I got this partly from speaking to the people there, but also if you just look at the demographics, he got that on the basis of class. If you were able somehow to strip away all the incendiary language that has attracted so much of our attention, what you actually get is someone who is running a ticket that's left of the Democrats to a group of people that have traditionally been voting Democrat. And they saw in him not the racist and the misogynist. That wasn't really what appealed to them, I don't think. They saw in him a guy who used to be part of the system that's screwing them and has promised to come and join their revolutionary army as he brings that system down. Mm. And so I think what's happened here, yes, race is there. Yes, misogyny is there. Yes, that kind of nativism is there. I'm not denying its existence. But the thing that won the election, the thing that swung the result, I think, was the surging return of class in politics. And that confounds us because we don't talk about class in politics, not in any kind of serious way. Class was something that kind of went out with the end of the Cold War. Maybe if you were lucky, you held on to it that long. I think that has kind of disappeared in our political reckoning, in our political imagination. We view politics almost solely now through the prism of identity. And so when Trump emerges, we view him solely through the prism of identity. And maybe some of his voters do too, but I got a feeling a lot of them don't. And there's a wonderful saying that I've heard from broadcasters here in the United States, which hasn't made its way to Australia, and that is, that Trump voters, they didn't take Trump literally, but they did take him seriously.
Hmm.
And that was when he was talking about the anti-systemic things that are at their base, class-based and economic, that allowed them, gave them permission to vote for the revolutionary. And I don't actually think they expect the guy to be the racist misogynist that we've seen. Some clearly do. I'll say it again, particularly in the southern states that Republicans always win. But some don't.
It does trouble me quite deeply that precisely those aspects, if you like, of political discourse and political deliberation that would have been safe territory for Democrats to engage in and engage in robustly were almost entirely ceded to a kind of, if you like, an almost an economic opportunist. It also does strike me, though, Waleed, that, you know, all of our conversations over the past year have been about the identity crisis in the Republican Party, that they could put forward somebody like Trump. I've been convinced for a long time that this has been a mask. I mean, our preoccupation with the personalities involved here have been a mask for one of the real crises that's involved, which is the crisis of the Democratic Party. I mean, there's no sense in which there's a clear idea of what it is that Democrats in fact stand for. And I think that was to some degree present in some of the dissatisfaction surrounding Hillary Clinton's approach to foreign policy. But even more than that, you know, there was something quite deep, quite robust and historically recognizable in Bernie Sanders' appeal. Two people, for instance, in West Virginia, two people in
Michigan. Yeah, he probably wins those states if he runs against Trump. Yeah.
But look, the one thing that I'd want to put in there, and I think one of the, it would be catastrophic if our takeaway from this is that it's just a whole lot of pissed off, disaffected, poor white people who put Trump in power. I don't think that's the case. And I think, I mean, some of what we've seen coming out of the exit polls, I think are confirming that. Instead, there is a strong sense of deep disconnection with politics as such. And that disconnection is among educated white voters and among non-educated white voters. And so in a real sense, what Trump represents here, what Trump's victory represents, is a dissatisfaction with the very language, with the terms, with the stock in trade, if you like, of contemporary politics itself. And that's something we're going to have to be talking about for a long, long time.
The change candidate in the way Obama was.
Absolutely. And thus the recipient of whatever protest vote there was to make.
Yeah, and I think there's a conspiracy of left and right here to create the field. It's the failure of both of those wings of politics that have helped Trump exist. That I absolutely believe that. All right, there's a lot that we can try to dig into. I think we've probably reached the limit of our wisdom, so we'll get someone who's far wiser than us to help us out. You're listening to The Minefield. You can leave a comment on our website. Search for RN The Minefield if you would like, or tweet us at RN The Minefield.
Our guest today is Shadi Hamid. Shadi is the senior fellow in the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World at the Brookings Institution. He's also the author of a fabulous book called Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. And he joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Shadi.
Hi, Scott. Hi, Waleed. Thanks for having me.
Shadi, you've spent most of your career studying the rise and fall of illiberal democracies in the Middle East and North Africa. This must all seem a little bit too close to comfort for you. I mean, there's been something decidedly illiberal about Trump's campaign and about the rhetoric that he's used to appeal to the American people.
So you're exactly right. I mean, I've thought a lot about illiberalism in the Middle East in particular, and this is illiberalism of a religious variety when we're talking about Islamist groups that believe that Islamic law should play a central role in public life. So, I've been thinking a lot about these issues. I guess I just never thought it would happen here. And, you know, during this campaign, you know, I always thought that Trump was an unusually compelling candidate. And I remember the first speech I saw of his at a rally, I thought, okay, he is actually charismatic. He's a fascinating speaker to listen to, even if he's also petty and vindictive. So I could sort of understand it because I understand the appeal of strongman politics in the Middle East. But I guess I never took it to the logical conclusion of actually being able to visualize him winning, because for me, illiberalism has always been something I study elsewhere, and not just the Middle East, but we also see it more recently in places like Poland and Hungary. And I have such a stake in the American project as an American, as a child of immigrants. I believe in the American idea. I could never bring myself to believe that it could really, truly happen here. And I think that was a failure of my own imagination. And, you know, it's also reflective, I guess, of a kind of personal bias that I didn't want to believe this about my own country, because in a way, and you said this earlier, you wake up the following morning, and I don't think I've felt this way before. I've never cried about politics before, and I have to just be honest about that. And I try to keep some remove from the things that I study, but this is my country.
Yeah, is it?
So, and this is where, and we always used to joke. I mean, those of us who live in the bastions of northeastern liberal elitism in places like D.C. or New York, we would always joke about not knowing our own country. I mean, we haven't spent time, a lot of time, most of us, in the South or the Midwest. And, you know, and it's not a joke anymore. And I think that... and I remember thinking this to myself with the Democratic National Convention in late July. And part of what I try to do in my work on the Middle East is to try to understand people who I disagree with, or people who I would never agree with ideologically, let's say. So in this case, Islamist groups. And what I've done in my own field work in the region is to immerse myself in the world of political Islam. And my starting point is always, as a researcher, we don't have to like the people we study, but we have to do our best to understand them and if appropriate, empathize with them. And I remember thinking to myself with the DNC convention that if I was a member of the so-called white working class and I was watching the images of the Democrats with their rainbow coalition, with their celebration of diversity, and it was so joyous and it was so optimistic. And if you're someone who's living in a forgotten part of the country and you have these liberal elites disdaining you and looking down at you and always thinking that you're racist and you're this and that, and you look at these images of a joyous country, you don't see your own country in those images. So I think that part of it is something that we as so-called liberal elites, I don't think we were really willing to contend with that in a serious way. So almost, you know, if you look at it in a certain from a certain perspective, why wouldn't members of this white working class vote for Donald Trump? Because what Hillary Clinton, as competent and smart as she is, was promising was variations on what we've seen the past 8 years. She would continue Obama's domestic legacy, and she would tinker around the margins. But if you're someone who's felt disaffected for the past 8 years, why in the world would you vote for four more years of that? You might say to yourself, hey, things are pretty bad. I don't recognize my own country. No one cares about my predicament. I'm going to shake things up. And I'm going to vote for someone who actually said quite explicitly, I am your voice. And, and we talk about the dismissive attitudes, and we even have a phrase, the phrase white trash, which captures that dismissiveness here in the U.S. And if you have for the first time a major party candidate who is saying, I will not forget you, I am your voice, that's going to resonate with you. So is that racism? Is that white nativism? Yes, there is some element of that, but I think it goes deeper to something that is very inherent in all of us, which is we want to recognize ourselves as part of a larger group. We gravitate towards people who share our same sensibilities, whether it's religion, race, ideological beliefs, so on and so forth. So I don't think that's the same thing as pure racism. I think that's human nature, that if you're a white person who feels forgotten in the South or the Midwest, you're going to relate more to other people who are like you, who share your predicament. You're going to look at someone like me, Shadi Hamid, who in a way, I mean, I don't experience white privilege, but I experience a different kind of privilege as a member of the so-called dreaded establishment. And you're going to say, hey, you know, this Shadi Hamid guy, I don't get him. I don't know what he's about. I don't recognize myself in him.
Well, but more than that, I think you're going to stop and say there are people speaking to Shadi Hamid, and there are people Shadi Hamid gets to speak to. Who's speaking to me? Where's my story in this national story? And I think that's why, Scott, I was talking before about, or sort of gestured towards, the failure of both the right and the left here. Because, I mean, think about what the right now have. They have a candidate who's running rhetoric that's left-wing economics.
Hmm.
And the left has its traditional base voting for this guy. And, or at least parts of its traditional base. And I can't help but think that's because what the left's ultimately done is channeled, you know, at the end of the Cold War, when the economic debate was more or less over, and at least that's the way it seemed, it's channeled all its politics, all its progressivism, into the field of identity politics. Mm. So that's why, when Shadi, when you talk about the rainbow coalition behind Hillary Clinton, what other sort of coalition could there be? You know, and the thing that vividly sticks out in my mind is, you know, all the sort of upwardly mobile, well-educated tech millionaires out in Silicon Valley are probably voting Democrat these days, at the same time as they make the technology that's going to take these people from Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin out of jobs.
Mm.
And they're the people that probably the left should traditionally be trying to target, or that should be the home base for the left.
Well, there's a huge crisis within what we call the left right now, and I even hesitate to really call the Democratic Party the left per se. I would say, you know, it's sort of center left. But this gets at, I think, at a bigger problem, which is that classical liberalism, the liberal tradition, and the left in America, what it's sort of morphed into is a kind of placid center-left managerial technocracy. It's about nudging. It's about tinkering around the margins. It's very fact-based. It's very policy-oriented. And that doesn't speak to something which, again, you know, I don't want to get into, you know, human nature or maybe, you know, moral philosophy too much here, but what a lot of us are actually looking for at the end of the day is a politics of substantive meaning. And technocracy does not offer that. And that's not just in America. It's in Britain. It's in continental Europe. It's throughout the world, the Philippines, the Middle East, you name it. Some people find this meaning in religion, as in Muslim-majority countries oftentimes. In places like France or Poland, they find it in illiberal ethno-nationalism. But what connects these different strands, though, is a kind of disaffection with this liberalism, which says, hey, anyone can find the good life in their own way through the individual search for meaning. But a lot of people find that it's chaotic, it's empty, there's not enough structure, there's not enough guidance, there's not enough community and belonging and family. Yeah. And that's who we are, as we are beings that need that. And I hope that, you know, if I can try to search for some silver lining here, I am sad. I wish it turned out differently. But I hope the one thing we can all learn from this is that the liberal left needs to rethink its basic assumptions about human beings. We don't act according to rational economic incentives a lot of the time. That's not who we are. And when people say things like, oh, Trump supporters are voting against their economic interests because there's going to be massive tax cuts that benefit the rich, hey, that's probably true. But people aren't being rational in this very narrow economic sense. They're valuing things which mean more to them, which they associate with culture, identity, and community. And if we can't offer, and this is something that I've been writing about a little bit over the past 24 hours and thinking about, is, you know, liberalism needs a fighting faith. We need to know what we stand for. We need to articulate a vision that inspires people instead of telling them that we're going to give you slightly better universal health care. That's good and I support it, but that's not going to rally people in the end.
Thank you very much. That's Shadi Hamid, who's a senior fellow in the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World at the Brookings Institution. His book is Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Shaping the World.
after the broadcast was finished, Waleed and I had the great privilege of being able to hang around for a while and speak with Shadi Hamid from the Brookings Institution. Shadi, I think the way that you framed things just towards the end about almost the kind of the bureaucratic, technocratic, almost procedural justice that follows on from John Rawls even, I think that was absolutely right. One of the things that strikes me is that even Rawls himself recognized that for justice to be not only sustainable and stable, but also to be life-giving within modern democracies, it needs what he described as the sense of justice. In other words, the feeling of what this procedure ought to be about. And that sense of justice can't be separated from deep forms of belief, from empathy. But even, I mean, more than anything else, I think this is what's fascinating and often missed about Rawls, is that more than anything else, that sense of justice is nurtured by our capacity to communicate with one another and to hear one another. And I'm just wondering, I take everything that you said as read. I think that's absolutely right. I couldn't agree more about the need of a kind of fighting faith within liberalism. That, incidentally, is what used to be called civil religion, but that's another conversation for another time. I just can't help but think here that the incapacity that the media seems to have built into our democratic life, the incapacity to listen to one another, to hear one another beyond opinion polls, isn't that part and parcel, if you like, of this inability to feel what justice ought to be about, to incline ourselves towards our fellow citizens?
So I think it's a problem of justice, certainly. It's also a problem of empathy. And but I think it also goes both ways because, I mean, there are a lot of people in my country, in America, that are accepting a president who has said terrible things about the minority that I'm part of. Mm-hmm. I'm Muslim, right? So I think that, and this is what makes me quite nervous, is because we can talk about justice, but we have different conceptions of what a just society is. And, you know, normally when you have existential divides in the developing world, we would talk about the need for truth and reconciliation, for national dialogue processes. But in established democracies, we don't really have institutionalized mechanisms for that kind of deep reconciliation because we've never felt the need for it because we, you know, the U.S. has been a successful democracy for the most part. So that's why I don't – so I feel like I have a good sense of what the problem is. I just don't know – I don't know where to take that really. And, you know, maybe one thing that I would just mention and so when I talk about a fighting faith, I'm talking about even going beyond liberalism in a sense. And I think that one thing that America has suffered from is the decline of mainstream Christianity, that Christianity – used to be something that wasn't just for far-right evangelicals, that it binded communities together throughout the country, providing that sense of belonging and brotherhood. And it's so interesting to me that, you know, people are desiring meaning in America, but they didn't find that meaning in Christianity. Trump is as, you know, as unchristian as you can get in his politics, right? So what's taken the place of this moderate or mainstream Christianity in America is something worse. So be careful what you wish for. And what's replaced it is a kind of white nativism or a kind of ethno-nationalism. Of course, class elements and other elements play a role. But I just worry, and we're also seeing this, I think, in Europe, that when you have a kind of menu of options to choose from, you know, different kinds of political theology, if you will, it used to be religion in Western Europe and the U.S. It's no longer that, and I don't know if the alternative is better.
And look, I should also point out that it's not as though American nativism is being viewed at the moment as an alternative to Christianity. Instead, one of the sad, terrible declines of the last three decades has been the extent to which nativism and white privilege and white resentment have been soldered to certain understandings of Christianity. And to my mind, I mean, that's the very fact that Trump could be embraced the way that he has, it seems to me, represents in many respects the low point of the history of American Christianity itself.
Hmm. I can't disagree with what's being said. I just am a bit wary of overstating the white nationalist element of this, because I think that, you know, in American elections, they always talk about which coalition you're putting together to get you into the White House, right? So there's been a lot of talk over the past few days about what Clinton's coalition would be, because it wasn't going to be the same as Obama's. So what group of people was she going to be able to pull together? And she wasn't going to get the same number of black people out voting. So was it going to be Latino? What was it, right? And I think it's no different with Trump. You're talking about a coalition. You're not talking about a kind of thoroughgoing commitment to this white nationalism, for example. I mean, note, although the numbers clearly weren't huge for him, he did better with black voters than Romney did.
That's true.
He did significantly better with Latino voters than Romney did. He won the white female vote easily. So all these groups that he was specifically targeting decided instead that they were going to see through that stuff or put it to one side or however you want to characterize it, and they were going to vote for him anyway because he was tapping into something that was bigger. And I really do believe that while the identity politics of what he has to say is crucial to understanding him, it's definitely not comprehensive.
Look, I don't disagree, Waleed, and I'd really be interested in what Shadi has to say about this. But, I mean, one thing that we have talked about on the show before that I think can't be sort of, you know, separated off is part of the problem of negative Democratic politics, or if you like, the politics of disaffection, is that when you gather together, when you cobble together these coalitions of the disaffected, that then has a kind of homogenizing effect on all of those elements of the coalition, so that something...
Which is artificial, yeah.
Which is artificial, but it's nonetheless communicative, and I think that's the point. Something that may well be fringe, when it has a strong symbolic resonance, if you like, in the overall appeal, that ends up becoming homogenized across the... In other words, the election of Trump has sent an enormously troubling, illiberal, morally disastrous message, I think, to American Muslims that many people who voted for Trump may well themselves not have intended, and yet it's part and parcel now of, if you like, part of the toxic political climate.
I completely agree with that. Yeah.
So I think this is actually so part of it that I totally agree that for many Trump voters, white nationalism wasn't maybe the number one motivator, even the number two or number three, and I take that. But at the same time, in voting for Trump, they essentially said that white nativism was not disqualifying for a candidate, because they knew what Trump was saying about minorities, about Muslims. They knew how he was playing footsie with groups like the alt-right and other kind of white supremacist groups. They
definitely
knew that.
But what do you say to the Latinos who voted for him, even though he spoke about Latinos in that way?
Hmm.
That I'm not sure.
That's what I'm seeking to explain here. This is what I'm saying. I get that white nationalism isn't the number one thing for a lot of people, but I actually don't think it necessarily means that everyone who voted for Trump bought into it, or even was particularly keen to be permissive about it.
Mm.
I think they actually just saw it as window dressing that was largely irrelevant. They saw it as just, you know, the wrapping paper that was obscuring what the real product was here, what the real gift was.
But that complicity has political consequences.
I'm not denying that at all. But doesn't it mean that if you're a Democrat, or if you're in any way on the other side of the political spectrum to Trump, what you need to do is cobble together your own coalition that somehow includes white working class people? Imagine if you could cobble together a narrative that includes white working class people and puts their experience in the same basket as African American working class people, of whom most African Americans are in that category, and Latino working class people. You would suddenly become unbeatable, and you wouldn't need the white nationalism to hold it together.
But how do Democratic Party elites speak to those groups? I mean, it's hard for me to. I take your point that they should be able to do that, and they should be thinking about how to do that. But the people in the Democratic Party and the people who support it, people like me, we don't know that language. We wouldn't know where to start. And
but
this
neither
is where
did
I
the Republicans
we...
until Trump came along, right? I mean, he's speaking very un-Republican language on everything other than culture and identity and race.
I think whenever we talk about white nativism, we automatically think, well, if anyone's buying into that, these are bad people or racist people or deplorables, if you will. But I think one thing, and this isn't, I suppose, politically correct to say on the left these days, but otherwise good people can be, you know, ethno-nationalists of one sort or another. I mean, to me, that doesn't necessarily... That's very disturbing to me as a minority, but does that make someone deplorable? And I also have to, I have a very dark view of human nature. So I think most people have very dark elements about them, whether it's racism or bloodlust or the willingness to kill or whatever it happens to be. And I'm also speaking as someone who's spending a lot of time in the Middle East and having my own family members in Egypt supporting mass killings of their fellow countrymen. So for me, I think to myself, and in this case, I'm referring to the secular elite in Egypt supporting the coup against the Muslim Brotherhood and the mass killings of the Muslim Brotherhood, which happened in 2013. So I think to myself, these are people who I like. They're my family. Some of them are quite dear to me. And I'm pretty sure that these are otherwise good and sensible people, yet they are capable of supporting evil things. So for me, that tells me something more universal about who we are. And that's why I was never comfortable with this language of deplorables and being so dismissive of Trump supporters as bad people or as stupid people, because you can be otherwise good and support bad things.
Can I just point out that what both of you have described previously, this is all part and parcel of the greater tradition of American populism, where working-class broad-based coalitions have been formed in order to achieve not so much national but local ends, and by trying to achieve those local ends, forms of identity that were considered irreconcilable or incommensurable are thereby overcome. So I think if there's any upshot from this election, it may well be that what's incumbent upon Democrats and the left more generally is to recover the tradition of populism itself.